Invite your attention this evening to Matthew's Gospel, Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, we're going to be focusing on verses 27 through 30 this evening. You know, I'm a big baseball fan, and I got tickled a few weeks ago. I saw a picture on social media, and it had a home that had been painted. And the caption said, "I made the mistake of asking Greg Maddux to paint my house." And the only thing that was painted on this large home was up underneath the eaves and the overhangs was just the corners of the house. Now, if you don't know who Greg Maddux is, he's now a retired pitcher, but he was famous for, in baseball terms, just painting the corners or hitting the edges of home plate. And as he pitched and as he progressed in a game, you could on the edges about how he was able to begin to quote-unquote nibble on the edges of home plate. And that is to say, he wouldn't actually throw a strike per se, but he would get the batters to swing at it, and as the game progressed, the strike zone would expand because of his reputation and his control to where the umpires would give him that strike. So now, what in the world does any of this have to do with Matthew chapter 5? Because in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is continuing his Sermon on the Mount, and he's addressing a crowd who likes to look at their own sin and compare it to the law or compare it to their understanding of the law and claim that they're guiltless before the law because they like to nibble the edges. They're only painting the corners with their sin. And so they feel like it's okay because we're not throwing it right down the plate. It's not a complete strike. It's not a complete violation of God's law or God's standards. So we're okay because all we're doing is nibbling the edges or nibbling around the corners of the law or what that standard is. And as Jesus is proclaiming his message to his audience, there's about four groups of folks that we need to kind of keep in mind that make up his audience. One of those groups is just your average run-of-the-day person in the first century. They may or may not be an active participant in Judaism. They may or may not think that they're okay with God or not. They're just trying to get through life, moment to moment, day to day, a lot like the majority of their peers. And then you had some folks that probably didn't care at all. They didn't care anything about God. They didn't really care anything about Jesus. They were just there to see what all the hubbub was about. Who's this guy? Who's this carpenter son? Maybe he'll do something cool that we can go home and tell people, I was there when this happened. And that's kind of the extent of their expectation. They just want to be part of what the buzz is because they couldn't go home and pull it up on Facebook or Twitter and see what all the rage was about. They had to go like Zacchaeus and maybe even climb up in a tree so they could see it for themselves. But they had no real expectation of what they were going to hear or what they were going to see. And then you had this group that probably thought they were okay. They were active participants in their synagogue, and they went to Friday night school or Saturday school, whatever you want to call it, that they would have had there at the local synagogue. And they believed themselves to be right and had been taught and trained by scribes and Pharisees. And they were curious as to what this new teacher was teaching about the scriptures that they had been learning about their entire lives. But they thought they were right with God to begin with. Because they lived not, then they would go believe to be a perfect and a righteous life as much as possible. And if not, then they would go offer the proper sacrifices and wash their hands in the right little bowl of water at the right little time so that they would be ceremonially clean and they were okay. And then the last group that you would have had there made up the group of the scribes and the Pharisees and the religious leaders who believed themselves to be the standard of righteousness. They believed that the way they understood the law, the way they interpreted the law, the way they shared the law with those who came to synagogue and sat before them was 100% right because they had studied it for themselves and they had read everything that the previous rabbis and the scribes and the high priests had written before them, and everything seemed to match up. And as long as we were keeping the rules and not breaking the laws the way we interpreted them, then we're A-okay, and we're right with God because we're doing what we have declared to be right. this group usually gets a little frustrated, gets a little upset with Jesus. And the reason they typically get upset with Jesus is kind of like the old story of the reason that the couple was getting a divorce when the judge asked. And it was one of the parties in the marriage believed they were God and the other one didn't. And so when he was asked, he said, well, we're separating for religious reasons. So the scribes and the Pharisees would show up and Jesus would begin to teach and Jesus would begin to explain things to them and they would get upset because Jesus was claiming to be God, and they believed not only that he wasn't, but that they in fact were. Even though they may not have spelled it out that way, they believed that their understanding of the law, their comprehension and interpretation of the law, was above that of Emmanuel, God in the flesh. And so naturally, there was conflict. And so Jesus, as he launches into this section, if you back up in Matthew's gospel, bless your righteousness, 17 through 20, in verse 20, he tells us, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And you read that and you think, wow, I can't believe Jesus would say that in public with them in his audience. Why is he picking on the scribes and the Pharisees? When in essence, what he's saying to everyone who's in attendance, regardless of their station in life, regardless of their theological education or lack thereof, is that your righteousness must be greater than that of humanity. Because the scribes and the Pharisees, if you were to poll the audience, would have thought they're the most righteous of us all. They're the ones that set the rules. They're the ones that tell us what the rules are. And so Jesus begins to then teach and explain kind of what he means. And he starts with a section telling us, you've heard that it said to those of old that you shall not murder, but if you've ever been angry at someone, you're just as guilty of murder. And everybody kind of panics. Because I'm sure they're sitting there thinking, well, yes, we've heard that said. I've never killed anyone. Have you ever killed anyone? No. Have you ever killed? No. Well, we've never murdered anybody, so I guess we're okay. And then Jesus doubles down on them and says, but it's not about whether or not you've actually murdered someone, but what's the condition of your heart? He says, are you nibbling around the edges? You're still guilty of sin. You may paint the corner, but it's still a strike. It still violates the law. And so look at where he begins. And this is the passages I want us to focus on this evening, beginning in verse 27 through verse 30. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Now Jesus begins because he says, you've heard that it was said, you've been taught not to commit adultery. And everyone's probably looking at themselves in his audience. Well, absolutely, it's one of the Ten Commandments. That's, you know, Moses brought it down from the mountain, written in stone. Yes, we totally get that, and we understand that. But when Jesus said that you had, he's basically saying, this is what you have been taught, that you shall not commit adultery. Everyone's agreeing as they hear this. Of course, that's what they've been taught. What Jesus doesn't say is that the definition of adultery had been so limited in its practice that the only way you could be accused of or convicted of, to use kind of legal terms, within a first century Jewish context of specific adultery, was that if you were a married individual who had a sexual relationship with another married individual, and that was not your spouse. So as long as you didn't do that, anything else was fair game because technically it wasn't adultery. So some of the religious leaders were having affairs all over the place. But if the person they were having an affair with wasn't married, then technically it wasn't adultery. So it wasn't a strike right down the middle of the plate. So they weren't guilty of anything because they were just nibbling around the edges. But notice what Jesus says. He says, this is what you've been taught. You've heard that it has to be this specific so that we can find a way to get loopholes. And our culture is great at this. I get amazed at work when I work with some of the folks that I work with, and they can't seem to think for themselves for a minute until they need to justify something. Then all of a sudden, they're all Johnny Cochran, and they can argue their way out of anything and everything. But don't let them need to be proactive to actually help or solve an issue. And this is kind of where the scribes and the Pharisees are. They can argue themselves and justify themselves in any way. So Jesus says, look, I know what you've been taught, but look at how he begins verse 28. But I say to you. Now, if you're thinking for a second that Jesus here is setting himself as a greater authority than the law, you're absolutely right. But Jesus doesn't view himself as a greater authority than the law. He views himself as the equal and same authority that wrote the law. So in the minds of his audience, he's saying, look, I know what the Pharisees have taught you. I know what old Rabbi Eli down here at the synagogue has taught you. But let me explain something to you. As Emmanuel, God in the flesh, here before you, this is what I am telling you. That everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now imagine being there in that audience and you're thinking you're okay. Red-blooded Jewish male of the day. And Jesus says, if you've ever looked at a woman with desire in your heart or lusting after her, then you're just as guilty. All of a sudden, the chests aren't puffed out as much. Now, when Jesus says, if you've looked at her with lustful intent, he literally has the idea of continually looking, seeking it out. This is not just the random glance here or the glance there. This is seeking it out with the intent of fulfilling a lust and carrying that out. For lack of a better way to put it, in a modern context, this would be anything that you could kind of throw under an adult entertainment industry or sex trafficking or anything of that notion. And Jesus says, if you participated in that at all, even whether you've done anything other than look or not, it doesn't matter. You're guilty of committing adultery. Notice the last part of this verse. Why? Because it's in your heart. Jesus wants his audience, he wants us to understand that the sin is more the desire of the heart than it is the deed of the individual. And the desire produces the deed. Now, he continues with this because he wants us to understand just how serious this is. Now, please understand, Jesus is not saying that you're equally guilty of adultery if you're guilty of lust. What he wants his audience to understand is you're equally guilty as a sinner before God. Not that you're guilty of the same crime or that you're guilty of the same sin or that you're guilty of the same act, because obviously the consequences are very different. But what he wants us to understand from a guilt standpoint is that whether we've actually committed the deed of adultery or not, if we've ever lusted in our heart, we're just as guilty at violating the holiness and the purity and the righteous standard that it takes to be right before God. In other words, we're guilty of only matching, not exceeding, the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. And so notice how he continues. And this is to show us just how serious it is. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members or one of your eyes than that your whole body be thrown into hell. Now, it's interesting that he says we're going to throw your whole body into hell because he's establishing for his audience the premise that the standard of righteousness to keep you out of hell is God's righteousness. It's God's holiness. God's purity, not your own. Now, before you start thinking, I didn't realize Christianity was this extreme, Jesus clearly is exaggerating to make a point. He's not saying go cut your eye out so that you don't sin. I don't know about you. I don't see a whole lot with my left eye that I don't also see with my right eye. Now, when I'm taking my contacts in and out, it can be a little different for a few moments in between. But it would be silly to think that what Jesus wants his audience to do is think, oh, no, well, I've lusted. Well, I looked at that woman with my left eye, so I have to cut it out. Well, did you not look with the right eye too? I mean, I often wonder, and this is the crazy part of my brain, is after this group of people heard this message from Jesus, if some of them walked around with a patch over one eye or the other just to keep from sinning with that eye. You say, well, why would you think that? Have you read some of the other stuff that the scribes and the Pharisees do and the laws that they've come up with? That would be perfectly in line with their way of thinking. But Jesus says this more so that we understand the seriousness and the gravity of what we might call even a little sin. Because the scribes and the Pharisees thought, hey, you know what? If I'm married but they're not, or vice versa, then technically we're not guilty of adultery because we can fight over the definition of is, or we can fight over what this means or that means so that we can arrive at the conclusion that we want to conclude to justify ourselves. But Jesus says, no, this is how serious it is. Pluck the eye out, because it's better to lose one eye than to lose your entire self into the pits of hell. Why? Because the wages of sin is death. That's what he wants them to understand. It's not so much let's get rid of an eye, because he's going to kind of take the metaphor a little bit further in verse 30. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better than you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. So he's continuing the same concept. So if it's not the eye now, cut off a hand, cut off an arm. There's only one problem with that. And that's that Jesus has already established that the sin begins, it germinates, it starts, its accountability is established not in the deed of the eye or in the deed of the hand, but in the heart. And that's what he wants them to see. Well, if you sin with your right hand, are you not capable of sinning with your left hand? If you sin with your right eye, are you not capable of sinning with your left eye? But avoid this altogether, because it's a matter of the heart. Why would he take the term of deed, per se? You say, why would he take the time and go to these what seems like almost radically extreme measures to explain his point? Turn over with me, if you will, to Matthew chapter 19. In Matthew chapter 19, we meet a man often referred to as the rich young ruler or the rich young man. I think this rich young man epitomizes the thought processes of someone raised and reared in the teaching of the scribes and the Pharisees and their idea of self-righteousness and potentially just nibbling around the edges. Jesus comes to him, or he comes to Jesus, and he says, what does it take to enter the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus said, well, you have to keep the Ten Commandments. You have to keep these rules and keep these laws. You remember what the rich young ruler says to him? He doesn't fall down on his knees and say, Master and friend, I'm incapable of meeting that standard of righteousness. No, he says, and I think with a bit of pride in his heart, as if who else hasn't, no, I've kept these and I've done so since my youth. He basically tells you, well, I've done that since I'm a little boy. If that's all it is, it's a piece of cake. And so Jesus then tells him, okay, go sell everything you have and give it to the poor. You remember what he does? He walks away sad. Now, Jesus' point in this encounter is not to tell all of us, if we want to enter the kingdom of heaven, we have to go sell everything we have and give it to the poor. Jesus' point in having this conversation with this rich young ruler is to get us to understand it's a matter of our heart. It's a matter of the disposition of our heart and not the deeds that we execute. So if the rich young ruler wanted nothing more than to enter the kingdom of heaven, he would have been content to give it all back to God. But because he wasn't, he wanted something easy, something convenient. He walked away sad. The real dilemma in this young man's heart is he did not believe he was guilty of transgressing God's laws. He did not believe he needed a Savior. Jesus wants his audience to hear and to know and to understand that above everything else, what they need is his righteousness, his mercy, his grace, down the oppression, to take up their lives, to lay down whatever it is that they had before him, and to take up their cross and follow him. So he says, pluck out your right eye, cut off your right arm. Not because he wants us to do that, but to shock us into recognizing the logical absurdity of thinking that my arm is what's guilty of sin, or that my eye is what's guilty of sin, or that that person that walked in front of me is guilty of causing me to sin. No, what Jesus wants us to see, what he wants us to understand, is our heart is what causes us to sin. And as he continues on, he's going to explain to them that the only cure for our heart, notice he doesn't say rip your heart out and throw it away. The only cure for that sinful heart is the blood of the Lamb. That same Jesus who's warning them about their condition is the same Jesus who will selflessly and willingly offer his life on a cross in our place, in place of everyone who was in that audience that day, whether it was someone who was just there to see what would happen or whether it was the most ornery, self-righteous Pharisee we can imagine. Jesus died on the cross for every one of us. Why? So that our hearts could be covered with his righteousness, and we could exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees and the scribes. In other words, we could get rid of the filthy rags of human effort and replace them with the pure garments of the righteous Lamb of God. So as we leave here in just a little while, I want to challenge us with kind of how we look at ourselves and how we justify things and think about how our heart is when it comes to our relationship with Christ, if we're serving him, or are we looking for ways to just kind of nibble at the edges, to just kind of paint the corners? Are we trying to go right down the middle in obedience? And you can look at that on either side of the coin. Is that us trying to justify things and justify behaviors and attitudes that we know are incongruent with the nature of Christ? Or it could be how we're not going wholeheartedly in to serve Christ in the way that the scriptures lay out. Because when he's addressing this crowd, what he wants is them to be shocked into recognizing, first and foremost, that before the throne of God, we're all the same. And what I mean by that is that we're all sinners in need of something we cannot provide ourselves. Only Christ can be the antidote, the covering of our sin. Where are we in that relationship? Where are we as we go out and share the gospel with the world around us? What kind of example are we setting? Are we putting on the righteousness of Christ, or are we trying to cloak ourselves in our own righteousness? And if it's our own righteousness, then we might as well cut an eye out, cut our arm off, figuratively. Don't walk out of here saying, I told you, you need to pluck an eye out or cut an arm off. My insurance won't cover it. And that would be all kinds of problems. But in essence, Jesus wants us to know, if I sin with my hands, it's not the hands' fault. If I sin with my eyes, it's not the eyes' fault. If I sin with my feet, it's not the feet's fault. We used to sing a song when I was a child, oh, be careful, little eyes, what you see. And be careful, little hands, what you do. Why? Because the Father up above is looking down in love. Be careful, O wicked heart, what you emote, where you think, and where you go. Because that's where it all begins. And that's Jesus' point in this entire section, is it's all about our heart and our relationship with Him. It's not about the ritual of what we do, but it's about the relationship that we have with Him. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father in heaven, we come to you tonight and we thank you so much for all that you do for us in our lives. We thank you for Christ and Him crucified and risen again. Father, just give us the courage, give us the strength to live by faith and to have an eye of faith and to see our hearts and to see our lives as you see them so that we can cling to you and seek your mercy and so that we can display that grace and that mercy to the world around us and share your love. Father, just keep us from temptation. Give us the courage to seek you out. Forgive us where we failed you, and keep us from temptation. We ask it all in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.